more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study.
You guys are sort of all over the world, it seems like.
It's kind of mind-blowing when you think about it.
Here on Inspiration Dissemination.
Actually photographs of this data set stretching over a much longer period of time.
They're now converted into basically mathematical shapes, and we can now analyze the statistics of this shape.
Good evening, listeners.
Good evening, listeners.
Good evening, listeners. Today is May 26th, and you're tuned into 88.7 KBVR Corvallis. It's currently after 7 p.m., and on a Sunday, that can only mean one thing. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Maggie Exton.
And I'm Heather Forsyth. At Oregon State, we have more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature their research and their personal stories every single week. And if you're a grad student at OSU and you're interested in coming on the show and talking about your research and how you came to grad school, you can find out more about all the awesome things going on here at our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration. And we also have a podcast and Twitter and Facebook pages, so you can check out any of those to find out more information.
Inspiration Dissemination is recorded live, and should they occur, any opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and their guests and do not necessarily represent Oregon State University or the station. Tonight, we are joined by Václav Kuna from the Department of...
College of Earth,
Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences.
Making troubles to say that every time. I've been around only for 5 years, so I don't really remember the name of the college yet.
So why don't you give us an intro to what you do here at Oregon State?
So I study seismology. So I study earthquake seismology. I study earthquakes, and I'm not interested in that much in earthquakes themselves, but I'm interested in how they are distributed in space and time and what they mean for motion of fault. So fault can release energy either via earthquakes or via some like aseismic slow motions. And I study how these two interact with each other. So and earthquakes are are providing us this information, like how fault slips and like how we can actually study the interaction between aseismic motions and seismic motions.
So yeah, can you tell us a little bit more about what seismic versus aseismic and what that means, and then earthquake, what that is, where that fits.
So seismic motion is the motion that we know better and we know more about. So that's that motion that we are actually afraid of, because that's the motion that causes damages all over the world. So when we have a fault, the fault is normally locked, and many of those faults out there, they can accumulate a lot of energy and then release it very fast over seconds or first couple of minutes when it comes to very large earthquakes. And those motions are very violent and very strong. So that's what earthquake is. It's like a release of accumulated energy on a fault. And that's what we call seismic motion. And also, it's kind of a newer thing, a couple of decades maybe. People started to observe that not all the faults are actually releasing energy via these fast motions, via these earthquakes or those seismic motions, but also they can just like slip over a long period of time. Like they are being loaded tectonically on rates centimeters per year, and they can also release this motion continuously, very slowly, or they can work in some kind of like in between regime where they accumulate the energy, but then they don't release it in over seconds, but they release it over hours or weeks. So that's what we call aseismic motion. So those are the motions that we don't even notice. If like one was occurring right beneath us right now, we wouldn't be able to notice that. But those might be important for assessing like how the fault works, and like those might be also important for nucleation, those seismic motions, those earthquakes.
So we have these two broad categories of motion. So you have like a slow sliding of these plates, and then you have like jumps. How do we measure this happening, I guess? How do we measure like the pressure, how fast it's moving, stuff like that?
So the seismic motion we can measure by seismometers. So we have some kind of, seismometer, probably most of the people know how they work. It's in the very simplistic way, it's some kind of a weight on the spring. So it, when actually like an earth shakes, the weight stays in inertia, and we can measure those motions, those fast motions. So we study those seismic motions of faults primarily using these seismometers and networks of seismometers. So there are like all sorts of networks. There are global networks that capture that like big global earthquakes that occur, but also we can deploy temporary networks of smaller shapes of those or like put them in networks in around the fault that we are interested in, and have like several tens or several hundreds of instruments around the fault, and we can really observe those like very tiny earthquakes that are occurring on the fault. So that's for the seismic motion. And for the seismic motion, for the non-earthquake motion, is it's a little bit more challenging, but on land we can use GPS stations. So those are frequencies, or like those motions are so slow that they cannot be captured by seismometers, but they can be captured by geodetically by GPS stations. So primarily that. And in the ocean, it's very, very difficult to deploy GPSs. It's impossible to deploy GPSs as we know them, but like there can be like some strain meters, something that measures slow slipping motion of a fault, but it's very challenging to do, and we haven't done it on our fault yet.
So seismometers measure the velocity of that location of that's moving? Like wherever you deploy it, you have a seismometer and it measures a speed and direction?
Yes, yes. They can measure either velocity or acceleration, depends on what kind of instrument it is. But yeah, it captures how the surface where we have the seismometer sitting on, how it moves in three components, so how it moves up and in two horizontal components, so in velocity. Yeah.
Okay. Who puts the seismometers into the ocean, and how does that work?
So in this particular project that I have been working on, it was my advisors and a couple of colleagues of his project that is funded by NSF, and they got this funding 2009-ish and deployed the seismometers mostly by themselves, with of course a significant help of the crew of the Oceanus and Revel ships, and there are also like so many volunteers involved, so it's taking many people, but it's mostly, yeah, there's like a scientific and technical party involved in the deployment. And the way it works, it's actually quite fun. So we have like a ship that is loaded with, 30 instruments at once. And we go out there, or they went out there, and the instruments look like a big yellow meter times meter times meter, 3 feet times 3 feet times 3 feet for Americans, box. Yellow box, and we can lift it up with a crane and drop it over the board of the ship, and we drop it approximately at the place where we want to have it. So like when it sinks down to the depth of 1 to 5 kilometers, wherever, like we drop it. Of course it drifts a little bit, but the drift is just several hundred meters, so we drop it somewhere where we want to have it, and then we make like a circle around the station when it sits down. And we echolocate it, so we communicate with the station, and we acoustically, and we determine the exact position of the station, and then we continue and deploy 30 of them, or how many, like it's loaded, and the station sits in there for a year and records data, so it has like a memory card in there and battery that is worth like a year, and then.
So you don't know if it's working throughout this whole year. You get them afterwards and you check the memory card and...
Yeah, we don't know.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's like high risk.
Yes. there's no way how to... I mean, if you had unlimited budget, and sometimes people have bigger budgets. For example, on the Juan de Fuca Ridge, there is an axial seamount area. So people have cabled in the data from the OBS station. So that's much more challenging. And that's for like long-term deployment in the ocean. But for the temporary deployment, it's not really like feasible like to do that. So like, yeah, you don't know. And it happens also that like you can recover the station after a year and find out that there's no data.
No data. That must be sad.
Fortunately, it didn't happen that much at this project that I'm working on. We are very lucky in terms of this. Yeah.
So someone else essentially collected the data that you work with. Have you gathered data for other people?
Yes. That's how it works in seismology mostly, it seems to me. It's very, you would have to be very lucky to come for a PhD and gather your own data and then process them and have a couple of papers from it, because it takes a long time to gather the data and do all this stuff. So the data work already collected when I came here to ISU, and I have been collecting data for other people that come after me. So we went to Nepal a couple of times or several times after the big earthquake in 2015, and we had like an aftershock, what we called aftershock study. We studied aftershocks of that big earthquake. So we deployed similar earthquakes as we had in the ocean. We deployed on land, which is, in a way, it's easier, but it has like challenges too, like driving all over Nepal, where there was just like magnitude 8 earthquake. So it was also quite challenging.
How soon after did you go?
We got there about 4 weeks after the earthquake. Uh-huh. We wanted to go right after, but because like the border was so like, it was very difficult to get there, like because of like the airport was like really flooded with all the relief stuff, and they didn't have time for seismologists, which is which makes sense. And also another project, we have a project in Caucasus region right now. So it's it's Georgia, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Russia.
Okay.
So that's like a big collaborative project where we work. And
cool.
Yes.
Yeah, and you go. How do you travel in that region, or in any, like, do you? You said you drive around in Nepal, but.
Yeah. So in Nepal, or both in Caucasus and Nepal, we mostly drove. So when we were deploying those stations, because it's a lot of material for every station, not only the station, not only the sensor by itself, but also like a big car battery, solar panels, and everything like that. So you cannot really carry it for like long distances, like we did several times, but we had to like hire some people to carry it, and because it's a lot of stuff. So mostly where you can get by pretty solid Jeep, you can place a station. And then like when we came for servicing the stations after several months, it was after monsoon, where like there were many landslides on all over the road, so we had to walk more. So the driving wasn't really possible then, but like you carry just a small backpack of like snacks.
Backing up to collecting your data in the ocean, so you can hear the sounds of an earthquake, but there's, I imagine, lots of other sounds happening in the ocean. Do you pick up a lot of other things, and do you remove that, or how do you sort through that?
That's right. There's a lot of sounds all over. So we can like hear ships coming by, or we can hear whales talking to each other. So that's fun. Like mostly it's not a problem for earthquakes. For our processing, it's not a problem, because normally those frequencies are a little bit higher than what we are targeting. So we are targeting like for small earthquakes, it's somewhere between 4 and 10, 15 hertz maximum, more like 10 hertz. And the deepest voices of whales are about 15 hertz, 20 hertz. So, and ships are, also a little bit higher frequencies, the engines. So, but we hear a lot, like we hear thousands and thousands of hours of whales all over, like migrating either north or south in the spring. So that's fun to listen to them.
So why do you, and these are from pressure gauges, which pick up or differential pressure gauges, which pick up sound waves because they're pressure waves. But why is it important to get that information? Or, I mean, is it for sound, or is it, are you looking for something else in the pressure readings?
Actually, the pressure gauge is not that much different from seismometer. Like, the principle is different, but it picks up a very similar signal to vertical component of a seismometer. So when you have an earthquake coming from beneath, it, of course, it shakes the seismometer. It records on the seismometer, but also the wave converts at the boundary from the solid to water. Like, it converts to a sound wave. So the pressure gauge actually picks up the same signal as the seismometer does. So sometimes those are like a little bit more like sharper. Sometimes the quality of the pressure gauge is a little bit higher than the seismometer for the first arrival, as we call it, like when an earthquake comes for the first time. So sometimes it's better to do the processing on some kind of processing on a pressure gauge. But also, like, the sounds that are coming from the water, like whales or ships and stuff like that, they both come, they are recorded on a pressure gauge, but they are also recorded on the seismometer because it also, like, shakes the seismometer. So they are not that different as it may sound.
Okay.
In water environment. Of course, if you had it, like, sitting on land, like, the pressure gauge would pick up, like, us talking here, but, like, it wouldn't. I mean, it would pick up somewhat like an earthquake, but it would have to be, yeah, really high frequency. Yeah.
So I think we have a clip of one of the, from some of this data, sound clip.
Yes, we do.
Can you tell us what we're about to hear?
So this is a good one, actually.
Okay.
So you should be excited.
I'm excited.
I'm excited.
So this is a section of one seismometer that records talking fin whales. I believe that there are two fin whales that are talking to each other, but I'm not a biologist, so don't take me up on that.
Okay.
And then actually, so it goes on for like 20 seconds, and then a large earthquake actually occurred in Haidagai in British Columbia. So that's a recording of that. Of noise of that big earthquake. So
where was this located, this pressure gauge that's acting like a microphone?
So this was one of our stations on the Blanco Fracture Zone, which is just west coast of Oregon, or just west coast, like some 200 miles west coast of Oregon. So yeah. So the Haidagai earthquake is coming from about 1,000 kilometers eyeballing distance, and it's filtered to quite high frequencies. Like, such an earthquake wouldn't have audible frequencies. Like, mostly it would be like lower frequencies that we wouldn't be able to hear, but because I was like playing with that to get like both the whales and the earthquake, I filtered it quite high frequency. And also, it's actually sped up 10 times because even the whales are quite low frequencies. Those are like 17-20 hertz, so what we're gonna hear is gonna be 10 times as much, like 200 hertz, and the earthquake about the same.
Okay, let's give it a shot. So that's the whale.
So those are the whales, yeah.
Yeah.
Cute. Yeah. Yeah. Man, and this is sped up.
Yeah, yeah. And there's the rumbling noise is the earthquake coming up. Okay. Must have been so creepy to be the whale at that point, like, hey man, what's going on?
Can you do anything with this whale data?
People do quite a bit with like a passive monitoring of whale sounds. So we can locate them. They can locate them. They can study whale behavior and stuff like that. So that has been done both on like pressure gauges or microphones and also OBS stations. What I got distracted by a couple of months ago, and what I have been trying to do is to use those whale sounds for some kind of subsurface imaging. So I am using it as a source of mechanical waves that can penetrate deep in the earth and bounce off layers inside of the earth. And by the time when they bounce off, you can calculate how deep those interfaces are. So I've been trying to do that. I don't know if it's of any use or not.
Okay.
So you've taken or done deployments in the ocean and also on land. Do you have a preference for which one you like, you enjoy more? I mean, it's all valuable data, but what do you enjoy more?
I have gone out on the sea only once, and only for a week. People spend months on the sea, but even that week, it didn't take me long to realize that I'm not that much of an ocean person. And I think that the ocean realized that too. So yeah, I really prefer the land, and partly also because normally where we do those like temporary deployments is somewhere high up in the mountains, either Caucasus or Himalaya. Or cool. I've been lucky enough to like be in those two regions because those are the seismically active regions. So seismology often takes you to places that are very pretty. And so I really prefer the land.
The steep mountains.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
How did you get into seismology?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think through physics. I kind of liked physics when I was at high school. And also, like, we had a family friend who was a seismologist. So I talked to him, and it seemed to me that there's like a lot of work to be done. There's still like so many, like, especially in terms of like both scientifically, of course, but also in terms of seismic hazards, that there is a lot of things that can be improved. Because what we could see in Nepal, and like we can see over and over in all the areas that are affected by earthquakes, is that there is a lot of relief that is coming after a disaster. But it of course helped, and it's great that like international community gets up and like tries to help as much as possible. But even if like 1% of that money were invested like before that thing happened, it probably would be like even more beneficial for the people. So I think there's still like many areas, like I think the US or Japan, they are kind of prepared for most of it. Like there's still like plenty of things to improve, but places like Nepal or Indonesia or like so many other countries, like we could see it in Haiti, like just comparing like how many people were killed by the tsunami in the Indian Ocean, and then comparing to the Tohoku earthquake, like where it was like 30 times less. And I'm not saying that those are the same areas, but just, yeah, preparedness yeah. is the key for this. And I think there's a lot to be done.
So where did you do your undergraduate degree?
I am from the Czech Republic originally. So I did my undergrad and master's in Prague at Charles University.
Cool.
Yeah. Why? What made you come to OSU?
I think I was very lucky. My former advisor knew my current advisor, and they kind of talked. And my current advisor said, "Hey, like, I have funding for a PhD student. Do you want to apply?" And I said, "Yes."
Great.
So that's pretty much the story. And I have never been in the US before. It was like my first time in the US. I had to look up Oregon in a map. And so that was funny. Yeah, it was kind of a coincidence.
Yeah. So have you enjoyed Oregon since you've been here? What do you do for fun?
I really enjoy Oregon.
Yeah.
Oregon is good. especially the outdoor stuff is really fun in here. So what I did back at home a lot, I used to be canoeing. Like when I was a teenage, I was like doing competitive like canoeing. And then when I came up here, there was so much of whitewater. So I like started to whitewater kayak.
Cool.
And it's really fun, or it has been like was fun before I messed up my shoulder. And then other outdoor stuff too, like running is good. And yeah, a lot of things.
All right.
And also, like, actually the reason why I came in the US. I was lying a little bit before. The reason was because, like, I really wanted to have that, like, pickup truck from 50s, that old one. And because those are great. And we don't have them in Europe. Like, you can't find those. So that was the first thing when I came here a couple of weeks after. I bought an old pickup truck that had pretty much zero value, but I bought it for $1,000.
Amazing.
From the 50s?
No, it was more like early 80s. But okay. Still, okay. It didn't work.
Did you fix it up?
I tried to. I mean, it was running for several years. I did a lot of things on that, but then it was just like not really feasible to do that anymore.
Sad.
But I got another like car without any value, so.
So that void has been filled again.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, we have a couple of traditions on inspiration dissemination. Number one is giving a piece of advice to someone who maybe is in a similar position as you were a couple of years ago or leading up into the career you have now, or to a former self, maybe.
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and I think that maybe for PhD, my advice would be if somebody's working on PhD, I think my advice would be to like be curious about stuff, because I think that like PhD program gives you a lot of time and a lot of don't tell this to my advisor.
You're live on air.
But it gives you actually quite a bit of time and space to be curious about not maybe just your like very narrow like scientific field that you are studying, but also just be distracted by other like pieces of like that are still related to your science and that's still related to what you do. But at the same time, like it teaches you a lot to be like, just to think a little bit outside of the box. I don't like this cliche, but I just said it.
It's
up.
Useful. We know what you're talking about.
So I think that it's actually quite good because like. I'm a little bit worried that like once you enter a real job or like postdoc and like real academic career, like you will have different troubles and like you won't have time for like exploring like your field as you have on a PhD. So I think that's actually, and you're also like somewhat unbiased by like too much of knowledge. Or maybe I'm just talking from my own perspective because I don't know much, but it seems to me that like more you know, like harder for you it is to do things that have like very little chance to succeed. And I think that those things are important to try when you are on a PhD.
Sure.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks. And our second tradition is requesting a song and we'll play it. So what is the song that you requested?
So I requested the Death South, a Canadian, I guess, bluegrass band.
Cool.
And yeah, it's called In Death I'll Be in Good Company.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for listening. If you want to support the show, please tell your friends about it and give a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts so other podcast peeps can find our show.
The theme music was performed by the OSU Drumline, and the intro jingle was created by Olin Hannum. Special thanks to the supporting staff for KBVR that allowed this show and podcast to be possible.
The show was started by Gian Convar and Joey Holber in 2012. Its hosts include Matt McConnell, Steve Friedman, Mackenzie Smith, Kristen Finch, Adrian Gallo, Lillian Paget Cobb, Lori Lutz, Heather Forsyth, Maggie Exton, Scott Classic, Marcus Weinman, Daniel Watkins, and Harrison Steierwalt.
To learn about other graduate students at Oregon State, or if you want to be part of the show, please visit our well-curated website at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration.
And finally, don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter at KBVRID and Facebook at Inspiration Dissemination.
Thank you for listening, and stay curious, my friends.